Good morning. May it please the court. Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia. The district is entitled to judgment as a matter of law on Plaintiff Goins' claim because he had insufficient evidence of a known protected activity. The district is also entitled to a new trial after the plaintiffs dramatically impeached Commander Grooms, the district's decision-maker and alleged retaliator. The court unfairly prevented the district from repairing her credibility. Thus, the jury saw as conceded the impeachment of her, our main witness on this key point, even though the district would have been able to present strong evidence rehabilitating her. The trial was also unfair because the court excluded other powerful evidence rebutting the plaintiff's claims, evidence that Commander Grooms exercised her discretion to the benefit of the plaintiffs in the same period that the plaintiffs alleged that they retaliated against them. Finally, the plaintiffs deprived the district of a fair trial by the repeated improper golden rule arguments, which the court's belated curative instruction did not remedy. As to the first issue, Plaintiff Goins presents only speculation, not evidence of a known protected activity. He points...
Well, could the jury make a fair inference that when he talked about unfair treatment, it was in the context of his supervisor's statements about the A team and the B team and different assignments?
No, Your Honor. First of all, Plaintiff Goins is in a separate unit. He's in the auto theft unit. The anonymous complaint letter, for example, dealt with the other unit, the focus mission unit. There's no connection between the two. And I think.
But Wilkins is the supervisor of both, right?
He's the ultimate supervisor of both, but there's nothing in the actual statement.
So he had to use the word what?
Well, we're not suggesting there's magic words, but to simply say that there is unfair treatment and that I spoke up about things I disagreed with, that is not an allegation of unlawful discrimination, which the statement to Lieutenant Wilkins would have had to have contained. He acknowledged that he never stated race discrimination was at play. He acknowledged that he never stated to Lieutenant Wilkins that there was some differential treatment that was based on race. Going to the second alleged activity, which was protected, the August 24th letter, there's no evidence that any allegedly retaliating official knew of this letter. The plaintiffs acknowledged that they sent this August 24th letter to outside agencies, not the Metropolitan Police Department, that they told no one within the Metropolitan Police Department of the letter.
Is there a reasonable inference that Grooms had read the letter before action was taken?
No, Your Honor. All the officials...
You can draw that inference?
No, we again believe that that would be speculation. It would be... the facts here are even weaker than the facts in Talavera, where this court held that there was insufficient evidence that the allegedly retaliating official knew of the protected activity.
Well, the response is that Grooms relied on Wilkins, all right, so that she was getting her information from Wilkins. And I guess your response is that she made her decision on August 14, and the letter was August 24.
Correct. We know the decision to reorganize was by August 14th, and so at that time, obviously, she couldn't have known of a letter that had not yet been written. And so that's why the evidence is insufficient, yes.
Was Goins asked about the August 24th letter? Or did he testify about it at all?
He testified about it, and I believe his testimony was consistent with the other plaintiffs, that they told no one within the Metropolitan Police Department about the letter, and that it was sent to outside agencies, not the Metropolitan Police Department. If I could move on to our new trial arguments, the court erred in establishing an irrebuttable presumption that Commander Grooms, our key witness, testified falsely. The plaintiffs elicited from Commander Grooms the fact that Plaintiff Goins had not applied. They elicited this in order to impeach her with Plaintiff Goins' purported application. Once this dramatic impeachment was completed, the district was prevented from rehabilitating her. The district, for example, couldn't use that same application with which she had been impeached in order to rehabilitate her. The plaintiffs were allowed to retroactively redact exhibits that they had already published to the jury supporting Commander Grooms' testimony so that they no longer supported that testimony. The district had to redact its own exhibits so that they did not support Commander Grooms' testimony.
The plaintiff's response in part that it wasn't a retroactive redaction, but it was done at the time it realized it was necessary in light of how the district was proceeding with its defense?
I suppose that might be the argument, but the point is that the plaintiffs opened the door at the moment that they impeached Commander Groom. So once they opened that door through that impeachment, the district was entitled to rehabilitate, regardless of whether the evidence that it wished to use might be inadmissible on some other grounds. That's the open door doctrine, that even if that evidence is admissible, it can still come in and has to come in, we respectfully submit. That's the Griffin case, the Henderson case, the Gaines case from the circuit that we've cited to, this open door doctrine. And at that point,
this is this curative admissibility.
Yes, I think that's
that Henderson talks about.
That's the same concept.
So here, where the district failed to produce the records, and the district court ruled that the district therefore could not do anything in the nature of impeachment relating to whether or not Goins had applied to the auto side, reapplied to the auto side, then you're saying that because the plaintiffs used the one-page application, the district was, these are my words, obviously, absolved of its failure to preserve the records?
Well, I think once the plaintiffs opened the door, that point became moot. We disagree with the premise, of course. We don't think there was any spoliation of a second page. There was no evidence of any spoliation of a second page to that application. But even assuming the court was warranted in giving, for example, a permissive adverse inference instruction, the court erred when that inference became mandatory. It became mandatory as a result of the court's earlier rulings, which had already prevented the district from rehabilitating Commander Grooms. And we think that is the correct statement of the law, that an adverse inference instruction is supposed to be permissive. That's the court's decision in the Webb case, for example. And as the Stevenson case, the Eighth Circuit case we cited to, says when you allow that permissive inference to become mandatory by preventing any rebuttal of the inference, then that is an abuse of discretion.
So let me just be clear on your understanding of the law here. The district was not prevented, as I understand it, from attempting to rehabilitate Groom's reputation with other evidence. Suppose she had been a major leader in affirmative action in the police department, something like that, and she had received commendations for her work in this regard. The district could have put that in, right?
That's true, Your Honor, but what was essential is that we rebut this particular claim that she
was not the creation of an irrebuttable presumption as you first described it. It simply was a limitation on what evidence could be used to rebut. Not a presumption, but to rebut evidence.
Well, correct. We could not present any evidence to rehabilitate Commander Grooms on the point.
You just told Judge Rogers that you could have presented evidence. Did I?
I think I said the law, under the law, we should have been entitled to present this evidence.
Let's go back a minute.
Okay.
Did not Judge Rogers ask you if you could not have used other evidence to rehabilitate her? And you said, yes, you could have. Did I misunderstand?
No, but that Judge Rogers was referring to other evidence.
Right.
Right.
So it's not an irrebuttable presumption, even if it were a presumption. It's not irrebuttable. It simply couldn't be rebutted by this evidence, right?
By evidence on point. Yes, Your Honor.
It was an evidentiary ruling, not the creation of some irrebuttable presumption, right?
I respectfully, Your Honor, I think the irrebuttable presumption was that she testified falsely as to this particular point. I acknowledge that we could have presented other evidence, but the evidence we wanted to present was evidence on point. And so when we can't present evidence on point, you know, there's nothing else we can really fill in that huge gap, the jury is going to take it as true that Commander Grooms testified falsely when she said that Plaintiff Goins hadn't applied.
So the district court did not accept the plaintiff's request for what I'll call a mandatory adverse inference, but just a permissive one. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I'm positing this as sort of a middle ground that the district court followed. I know in your brief you argue why it's not a middle ground, but at any rate, it wasn't a mandatory. It just said to the jury, you may draw these negative inferences. So your point is that with all of the limitations on your ability to rehabilitate, necessarily the jury had no choice but to conclude that Grooms had lied as to whether or not Goins had reapplied to the auto unit.
That's correct, because we were prohibited from rebutting the inference on this particular point as whether Plaintiff Goins had applied. And so, and the court did recognize that it was, quote, overblown and perhaps just too much to give the adverse inference instruction and also prevent any evidence to rebut that inference, but the court nevertheless, the effect of its rulings in total had that effect. And so that is part of the error in this case. Once the jury discredited Commander Grooms on this key point, material aspect of the selection process, we think it follows inevitably that the jury would have been less likely to believe her testimony in other respects as well. And all that was necessary for the jury to find retaliation, as in essence the court instructed, was to disbelieve Commander Grooms. And that's why the error is prejudicial in this case.
All right, so I just want to go back on one point. I gave you that hypothetical of evidence you might have been able to offer, and you said yes. But when, as I read the record, when the district tried to offer evidence that Grooms had done favorable things as to these plaintiffs at the relevant time, that evidence was not admissible, or it was ruled inadmissible, and in a nutshell, because we'd be into mini trials. And
well, yes, Your Honor, there is that other aspect of our new trial argument, that there was this evidence of favorable treatment that the court did not allow. I think the reason, Your Honor, it didn't allow it was not for that reason, but because, as it said, it's just not relevant. And I think that's the real underpinning of the court's ruling, which is a legal error. Favorable treatment of plaintiffs is highly probative. That's the Lau case from the Tenth Circuit, the Brady case from the Fifth Circuit. The same actor inference, which this court applies in discrimination cases, I think is analogous. It doesn't make any sense that a retaliator is going to retaliate against someone at the same time they're doing favorable things to the plaintiffs, in the same period of time, in the same form as the alleged retaliation is taking. That's the evidence in this case. And I would also point out that in particular, we weren't able to show that what plaintiffs claimed to be an instance of retaliation, which was discipline against Plaintiff Smalls, was in fact favorable treatment because Commander Grooms recommended against the discipline that was actually given. So the jury was left with the impression that what was appeared to be an indisputable incident of retaliation, we could have shown was the exact opposite, favorable treatment. And that prejudice results because then you just have a one-sided presentation of the evidence. You just have evidence of negative treatment coming in. The defendant can't balance that with evidence of favorable treatment in the same time period, in the same form as the alleged retaliation. I do see that I'm into my rebuttal time, but if there are further questions.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the closing argument. And in connection with the fourth instance, which I don't think is so much the golden rule argument as it is send a message argument, that do this not just for the plaintiffs but for everyone. And I'm curious why you didn't appeal the denial of the remittiture, even as an alternative. Because when you take the extraordinarily high damages with this instruction to send a message that the plaintiff shouldn't be treated like this, but no one else should be as well.
I agree with Your Honor's point that these are extraordinarily high damages relative to the evidence of emotional distress in this case, and it's clearly suffering. And I would agree, it is beyond the bounds of reason. But even assuming it's not, I think we still prevail on our new trial argument, because even if it's within the bounds of reason, it still shows that these improper arguments were influential.
Well, it is or is not in the bounds of reason. We can't consider that,
no,
can we?
I don't think it's before us.
You didn't bring it before us.
Correct, Your Honor. But okay. What I'm saying is that same point goes to our new trial argument as to the improper golden rule argument. In other words, we know that the golden rule argument influenced the verdict because we can look to the amount of the damage award and see
how. You don't know that the golden rule argument influenced the jury.
Well, I should say all we have to show is that there's a fair assurance that it did, the plaintiffs would have to show that there's a fair assurance that it didn't substantially sway the verdict. And I think that fair assurance is lacking, given the amount of the award.
What's our standard of review on the jury? What's our standard of review on the judge, the adequacy of the judge's instruction? Assuming Golden Rule argument applies to liability, what's the standard of review?
I do agree it's an abuse of discretion, but the court should have looked at the totality of the circumstances in exercising that discretion.
We're supposed to say we know that the court didn't look at the totality of the circumstances?
I think so, precisely because of the point we were just discussing, that the excessiveness of the award in relative to
Did
the
you
evidence.
You argue the excessiveness of the reward in this issue?
Yes, Your Honor. We argued that the award was excessive below, and we tied it to our Golden Rule arguments in this case. Yes, Your Honor. Under the Golden Rule argument, we did point to the specifically to the size of the verdict in relation to the evidence of emotional distress as evidence, as a strong indication that the improper Golden Rule arguments influenced the jury. We can look to that clearly.
You did not appeal the denial of the remitter.
That is correct, yes, Your Honor. And I know that I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless there are further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Jennifer Klar for the appellees. The appellant asks this court to set aside the jury verdict in a three-week trial by overturning factual findings by the jury and the district court and micromanaging the judge's decisions regarding the conduct of the trial. I'd like to start, before I turn to the remedial measures by the district court, with one factual clarification. To the extent that the defendant is arguing that the district court prevented the defendant from introducing any evidence of arguably favorable treatment by Commander Grooms after the plaintiffs engaged in protected activity, that's simply false. In fact, the district court admitted such evidence when it was arguably favorable and it was when it was not outweighed by other 403 factors.
What evidence was that?
This includes commendations by Commander Grooms to the plaintiffs. Those can be found on JA 483 and 343-4, and testimony elicited from the plaintiffs that Commander Grooms did not discipline them and treated them fairly and was a good manager after their retaliatory transfers. That's on pages 148, 556, and 558. So the district court was instead making a distinction between evidence that was arguably favorable and not outweighed by 403 factors and evidence that was merely showed Commander Grooms continued to sign and process routine administrative forms related to the plaintiffs after they engaged in protected activity and balancing other 403 factors such as prejudice and delay. Moving on to the district court's remedial measures regarding the defendant's spoliation.
What's your response to first the argument about Plaintiff Gomes' testimony?
Your Honor, the district court realized during trial that the claim that Plaintiff Goins did not apply for his position.
No, that he never complained about racial discrimination.
I see. Thank you. So Plaintiff Goins complained about racial discrimination in two ways. First, the August 24th letter, and I'd like to make a factual correction here to what the appellant said. The August 24th letter was sent before Plaintiff Goins was expelled from his unit. And the testimony of Commander Grooms that she learned information in a letter at the time that was only in the August 24th letter allows a juror to infer that she received the letter or learned of its contents.
And that was her reference to?
She testified when asked about
She referred to what? It's in your brief.
Yes.
Forgotten.
She said that a letter that the June 16th letter states that sometimes members were not advised of certain operations going on. This is page 269.
Right.
In fact, that's only in the August 24th letter, and despite defendant's argument to the contrary, it's nowhere else in the record. What defendant points to...
But what I'm getting at is there were all these complaints going on.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't have learned that, obviously, from talking to Wilkins?
She said something precise. She said that members were being excluded from operations. This was a specific complaint with a specific subheading in the August 24th letter.
But she made her decision about reorganization 10 days before the letter was sent.
And there had been other complaints before that, but Plaintiff Goins was not removed from the unit until after the August 24th letter. However, he had made oral complaints in addition beforehand, and the testimony is that those oral complaints were actually made even before the June 16th letter.
So, just so I'm clear, your point is when he complains to his supervisor that he doesn't like or not, he doesn't agree with things that his supervisor is doing, that's enough to raise an inference of racial discrimination?
Well, that's actually not all there is here, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just trying to pin down what there is.
Okay.
The district makes a big point of this, and I have looked in the record, and I have read Goins' testimony, and I do not see a reference to race.
There are three facts, Your Honor. The first fact is that in his testimony on page 477 to 480, contrary to what the appellant says, he actually does testify that his complaint was a complaint of race discrimination. He says, within my complaint, it was voiced, yes, sir, and it was clear in what I was saying. But that's not it.
Wilkins turned red-faced. I literally didn't see anything about race.
Well, he says his complaint was of race discrimination. Within his complaint, he voiced it and that it was clear in what he was saying. That's on 477 to 480. But there are two additional facts.
All right.
One additional fact is before any other individual had complained of race discrimination, Lieutenant Wilkins asked if an EEO complaint was going to be filed against him. And a reasonable juror could infer that since no one else had complained of race discrimination, he must have thought that the reason the EEO complaint was going to be filed against him was because he understood Plaintiff Goins to be complaining about discrimination.
Now, this was after the June letter.
Before, Your Honor.
All right, before the June letter.
He testified he complained before and after the June letter.
So any complaint that was made to Wilkins was necessarily about race because Wilkins had asked, are you going to file an EEO complaint against me?
Let me clarify. So only Goins has complained. Then Wilkins says, is an EEO complaint going to be filed? A reasonable juror could think, why would he think that? Unless he understood Goins to be complaining about race discrimination because no one else had done so.
When you say only Goins had complained, is that the June letter hadn't been
correct
sent, but the June letter was based on complaints before the June letter was sent.
Okay.
All right, what's your third point, just so I'm clear?
Sure. The third point is that Talavera teaches us that we need to take the complaint in context. And here the context is there is a written complaint that is expressly about a Title VII violation against the same supervisor of the same units that are together.
That's the June or the August?
The June.
All right.
During the same time period, and therefore a reasonable employer could understand them together.
Thank you. So now you're going to the evidentiary rulings?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two evidentiary rulings, Your Honor, here. First, in response to defendant's claim that Plaintiff Goins did not reapply for his position, but the applications necessary to respond were spoliated. The district court made a factual finding that this spoliation prejudiced the plaintiffs and issued a narrow remedial order disallowing defendant from making only this claim. The defendant was otherwise allowed to claim that Goins was not selected for legitimate non-retaliatory reasons. For a separate reason, there was a permissive adverse inference instruction, which is that defendant claimed that the selectees to the unit were more qualified than the plaintiffs, but spoliated the applications that contained their qualifications. And so the district court found that this prejudiced the plaintiffs and issued the permissive adverse inference. I think defendant confuses these two remedial measures when making its argument about rebuttability. I would want to respond to a couple things that the appellant said. First, about opening the door. First of all, this concept simply doesn't apply here. All the cases that the defendant cites about using evidence that was otherwise prohibited once the door has been opened or in order to rebut a witness, none of those are spoliation cases. None of those are cases where there's a remedial order due to some misconduct of a party.
Briefly put, though, did you use that exhibit, and were they barred from using that exhibit?
We did use that exhibit.
And were they barred from using that exhibit?
They were. May I explain further, though?
Yes, you may.
Okay. The district court made a factual finding that plaintiffs did not ambush defendant, but rather it was the other way around, that it was defendant's sudden reversal in position that resulted in this issue. So plaintiffs used the document to lay a foundation, expecting that the resulting testimony would be consistent with the discovery responses. When it was not, this issue was then raised at trial, and the judge, in his discretion, issued the adverse inference sanction. I also would note that allowing the defendant to then use that document would eviscerate the remedial order. Yeah. And then what the district court found necessary to remove some of the prejudice to plaintiffs from defendant's misconduct would be gone. In addition, I wanted to mention that...
My colleagues have questions on that issue. You may want to get to the jury argument.
Okay.
I don't want to run you out of time before you get to that.
I appreciate that.
We have some questions about that, I think.
Okay. Moving on to the closing. The defendant asks this court to overturn the jury's verdict and order a retrial based on the claim that the district court abused its discretion in responding to defendant's objections during closing. They take this position despite the following three facts. First of all, the contemporaneous objections made during the closing were sustained, and the state...
And yet, counsel kept going.
Yeah.
Correct, Your Honor.
Times.
Because these were not actually golden rule violations.
But the district court ruled that sustained the objections. Sustained it, and then counsel repeated it. District objected. It was sustained, then counsel did it a third time, and the objection was sustained, and the judge gave that instruction for the jury to ignore the argument.
That, Your Honor, if you would look at the Joan W. case out of the Second Circuit and the Forrestal case out of the First Circuit.
None of them will deal with the question that you just were asked by Judge Rogers, because this was a case-specific question. You were given that instruction, and you persisted in that line of argument, right?
I can assure you, Your Honor, that there was no no intent to violate the court's order or
any... I think that is a yes, that you were given that instruction and you persisted in that line of argument.
Well, there was no instruction, Your Honor. There was a sustained objection, and because the...
Because it was obvious. And counsel is smart enough to know exactly what counsel was doing. This is not subtle.
Your Honor... I would have to respectfully disagree with that. I think because
that counsel wasn't sophisticated?
Well, not that piece, Your Honor, but that because...
What did counsel think counsel was doing in asking the jury to put itself in the place of the plaintiffs?
Thank you for that question. Counsel was simply following the language of Burlington Northern, which says...
You know that Burlington Northern does not say what counsel said to the jury.
What Burlington Northern says is...
Your explanation is you were just telling the jury about the standard, all right?
And the standard is to put the plaintiff...
Yes, all right. So you deny that there was any violation of the Golden Rule at all?
That's correct, Your Honor, right. But you don't need to reach that, because okay. Even if the court finds that these were violations of the Golden Rule, The question, and the Edwards case discusses this, where there is a violation of the Golden Rule, the question for the court becomes, did the district court act properly or did the district court abuse its discretion in responding?
So the circuits are all over the lot on this. Would you not agree?
That
sometimes they reverse, sometimes they don't reverse. And what's your strongest point here as to why this court should not reverse?
Well, the circuits, I don't think, are all over the map, actually. What they say is where
I can cite cases that would say that where counsel, on three occasions after objections being sustained, persists, that at least two circuits suggest they would clearly reverse.
Your Honor, let me go to two answers to this. First of all, there are at least, I believe, six circuits that have held that a general or a specific instruction is enough. Two of those circuits have said have specifically considered the issue when there are repeated violations. That's Joan W. out of the Seventh Circuit, Forrestal out of the First Circuit. A general instruction is enough in the Second, Seventh, Eighth, Third, and First Circuit, and the specific instruction, curative instruction, is called ideal in the Eighth Circuit in the Barrera case, and in the Luce case out of the Fifth Circuit, it indicates that will salve the suit. So to the extent that Your Honor is referring to the Klotz case out of the Seventh Circuit, a 1959 case,
Joan didn't overrule.
Joan did not overrule, but it did indicate that a specific instruction or a general instruction can cure. And in the Joan W. case,
You were a member of this court and you were writing the opinion,
yes,
how would you write it so that counsel would understand that golden rule instructions are impermissible and not to be tolerated?
Yes. Your Honor, what I would do in that situation is follow these circuits that I've just cited by saying that the district court acted properly to cure this.
So counsel can continue to do this even though it's impermissible, even though the objection is repeatedly sustained, with a general instruction that you are to decide the case on the facts, not the emotion of counsel.
I don't think that it would give counsel license to violate the rule if that's the court's concern,
well,
and let me explain why.
I don't understand what happened in this case when an objection is interposed and the district court sustains it. Why wouldn't counsel have understood to stop?
Your Honor, because counsel was literally repeating the material adversity standard, unfortunately it was not clear.
That doesn't sound responsive to the question. The judge gave an instruction to the jury, which sustained the objection, which should have made counsel aware that the judge was holding this improper, and yet counsel persisted.
After the judge's instruction to the jury identifying the golden rule argument, there were no more objections by defense counsel that were given.
And I know that on the fourth instance, there was not a contemporaneous objection, but there was shortly thereafter, in the proceedings that followed, counsel did raise the fact that there had been four, and how to handle objecting in front of a jury is such a difficult area that we don't necessarily require him to object the fourth time. And also in that one, you did have that message argument in there. What did you think you were doing with that? When you told them, by ensuring the plaintiffs are made whole for what they endured, you ensure that others will be free to exercise their rights without fear. Yours is an important job, and we trust that you will do what is right.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
What did you think you were doing there?
There's the statement before that. By protecting plaintiffs' right to complain, you preserve the rights not just of the plaintiffs, but of everyone.
Thank you.
That's clearly, clearly improper.
Your Honor, the Burlington Northern case out of the Supreme Court explains the reason why retaliation
Burlington
is protected.
Northern, talks about the reasonable person. And what you should have done, or what counsel should have done, excuse me, is to say, now ask yourself, would the reasonable person hesitate to speak up? If the reasonable person knew that speaking up would mean that his boss would call a meeting with his entire office, every time a counsel uses you, that's why it's banned.
Right.
Because the jury is not supposed to put itself in the shoes of the plaintiff or the defendant, for that matter.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, again, even if what counsel did was improper, this district judge acted aggressively to cure any prejudice. And
are you persisting in believing that what counsel did was not improper?
I think that there is substantial case law that would support that it's not improper, but you don't need to reach that. And I think,
why would counsel risk the case in making such an obvious error?
Well, Your Honor, the reason that I don't think that in saying that the court doesn't need to reach this because the district court cured it is not a danger that folks will do this again is because plaintiff's counsel would not risk what was here a very strong case and having either the district getting objections during the closing.
That's close to saying counsel can do anything during oral argument.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
That argument is close to saying counsel can do anything during oral closing argument.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I don't think counsel, once this opinion comes out, would reasonably risk it and therefore would tread a more cautious path. So I don't think that you'll be telling counsel they can do anything, that they can do anything. I'd like to make one more point about this golden rule issue, which is the circuit courts, and I'm thinking right now of the Johnson case, say that there is great discretion given to the district judge about this issue of prejudice because the district judge is able to observe how this information came, these statements came in, and best observe if there's prejudice to the jury. Here, the district court found that there could be no prejudice to the jury after the district court sustained and gave the specific curative and the general instruction.
To say the district court has discretion is not to say that there's not a role for an appellate court.
Of course. This is an abuse of discretion standard, but there's also the great deference given to the factual findings of the district court regarding prejudice. I see that I'm over my time.
Yes, you are, and we've kept you there, so unless my colleagues have further questions. Did counsel have any time left for rebuttal? We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it. That's an offer, not a command.
I appreciate the offer, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
I
have a question. It's picking up where we've been on the closing argument. In the district court's opinion denying the motion filed by the district for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, et cetera, the district court referred to minimal prejudice as a result of this closing argument. What's your response, given that our standard of review is abuse of discretion?
I do think it is for this court to determine what the prejudice is.
Well, counsel argues, and there's certainly enough law out there that says, appellate courts certainly have a role, but in questions of prejudice, the district court was there, has the feel of the case, and is in a better position than the appellate court to evaluate the scope, nature, extent of prejudice. So when the district court here uses the word minimal prejudice, I wondered what your response might be.
Okay. Well, I do think it is incorrect to say that the prejudice is minimal, and I think this court can make that determination just by looking at the transcript here and what transpired. There were four separate golden rule arguments. The last one we could call send a message argument, but the district objected specifically to the four improper arguments and asked for a mistrial, and the court simply denied it. It didn't look at the totality of the circumstances as we suggested that it should, the fact that these were repeated violations, they were deliberate violations. Even though the court sustained the objection, the plaintiff's counsel escalated the impropriety of the closing argument rather than refraining from it. And so if it's simply the case that there's...
Finish your sentence and your time will be up.
Okay, thank you. I think that that unless reversal is given, that these arguments will be necessarily tolerated because the plaintiff's counsel or counsel can...
May I ask one question?
Go ahead.
I thought you did not object to the fourth one.
We submit that we did, Your Honor, because immediately after that discussion, the send a message discussion by plaintiff's counsel, we moved for a mistrial immediately after that, and we cited four improper arguments, and so that would have been the fourth. So we think it's clear from the context we objected to that.
It was not a contemporaneous objection, though. The argument was over. The jury was no longer in the room. It was you did refer to four instances. You did not list the four instances. Counsel did not list the four instances.
And in the new trial, I think you just talked about three.
Three, yeah.
Well, we didn't have the benefit, I think, of the transcript at that point. So I think it's just a recollection, misrecollection of the number of times. But the transcript clearly says we objected to four. And we think it's clear from the context.
In that transcript, in that one instance, you refer to four, but there was not a contemporaneous objection to the four, and there was no recitation of what the four were. So there really isn't any specific objection to this last improper argument.
Well, respectfully, it falls within several lines on the same page or the very next page of the transcript, our mistrial motion inciting the four instances. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Call the next case.